Hi, it's the show on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein.
And I'm Mark Brody, and this is our podcast version of the program. The show is one of our original productions. It's a curated program of news and features from Phoenix and the state, along with national and international stories.
You can also find segments and additional information at theshow.kjzz.org.
Thanks for listening to the podcast.
Good morning. Thanks for listening to the show here on KJZZ 91.5 in Phoenix with Mark Brody. I'm Steve Goldstein. Now time for the Friday newscap and some voices from the news this week.
The money, because they kept it quiet, probably was a mistake. They should have just owned it, told the people why, and said, this is why we're going to defend our shareholders, but we're going to defend our customers, and let's go have this discussion.
Currently, Martha McSally is defined at roughly 91% name ID. However, when you look at Mark Kelly, the place where he's most undefined or voters don't have an opinion is in rural Arizona. You know, that is not favorable to the Democrats. It's traditionally conservative.
The genesis of these lawsuits regarding tuition, constitutionality, all began when we won at the Court of Appeals and then at the state Supreme Court over the university's policy of giving tuition to people that do not have legal status.
We certainly appreciate the ruling of the appellate court in this matter. And it would be our hope that this would be the end of it. This has been a long, drawn-out affair that addresses something that the Board of Regents works on every day.
And with us to talk about the retirement of the head of APS, Don Brandt, and much more, are Marcus Dell'Artino of First Strategic and former Attorney General Terry Goddard. Guys, welcome. Thanks for being here.
Oh, great to be here with you guys.
Thank you.
Marcus, let's talk first about Don Brandt's announced retirement. Normally, I know, you know, Bill Post was well known when he left APS, but there's a little different buzz to Don Brandt leaving. How significant is that, and does it indicate a connection to some of the bad PR APS has been getting of late?
No, I don't think I think that these things are sort of well thought out and well planned. And I look, the timing is certainly interesting, no doubt about that. But I think it's I think everybody wants to sort of take a turn in the tumble. It's not an easy job, as the record clearly reflects. So I don't think it's one that you do for 20 years, and it doesn't, you know, it takes a toll. And so I don't think it had anything to do with what was going on. I think it was time for him to retire, go have fun with his wife, his kids, whatever it very well may be. But certainly the next the new leader of APS has a lot of work to do in a short amount of time.
But Terry, we can't deny, of course, all the PR hits APS has been taking, and Don Brandt is identified as the leader of the company, of the utility.
Yeah, he was the leader when they made some very bad decisions that went in contradirection from where this company has been in the past. You mentioned Bill Post. You mentioned some of the previous leadership, very community-minded, and as a matter of absolute principle, instructed their people not to be involved in the political aspects of regulation. In other words, not to be trying to manipulate the Corporation Commission. And Don Brandt went in exactly the opposite direction, spent, we now know, $10.7 million of APS money, Pinnacle West money, but it's pretty much the same thing, to elect two people to the Corporation Commission. They did it secretly. They used dark money as the vehicle. And frankly, I think that's I just hope and pray that this is a company that now rights itself and comes out of a very dark area that Don Brandt led it into. I think he made a series of serious mistakes, and one of them led to the death of some customers, and that, I guess, is scheduled for a Corporation Commission hearing September 4th. Mm-hmm. I don't know if he plans to testify, but the fact that he's retiring now may mean that he's not going to stand and face the Piper for that.
He's still planning to do
that. He is still planning to go. Okay, I was not informed about whether it's going to happen.
Marcus, how difficult do you think it will be for Brandt's successor to sort of shake things up and maybe, at the very least, get on better terms, for example, with the Corporation Commission?
On its surface, it's not that difficult, right? You make a very public statement that this company is moving in a different direction. You make some different staff choices that signals you're going in a different direction. And you go in front of the Corporation Commission and you pledge to them that the company's different and it's under different leadership and we're going to make things right. It sounds really easy when I say it in a couple of seconds, but let's keep in
so
mind.
So why didn't they do that a few years ago?
So, but keep in mind, like, there's hundreds of, there's thousands of employees at APS. There's millions of dollars, and it's a very, electricity is not as easy as walking in and flipping on your light switch, right? It's very, very complicated about how it gets to your house and how it's regulated and transmission and et cetera, et cetera. So, but from a very basic principle, it's pretty easy to fix this problem.
Terry, do you get the sense that that will happen? I mean, does it seem like there's a desire at APS to change and to move in a different direction?
I don't know. I don't speak from anything inside APS. I've been a pretty vocal critic for the last, 10 years. I do think very highly of the new president. I think he's somebody who has the capacity to do exactly what was described in terms of saying we're on the wrong track, we're going to fix it. He's just a really decent person, and I think has that. We could get back in the tradition. I do think there's a certain amount of mea culpa involved here, though. I think the company's going to have to very publicly say we were wrong, we made a mistake, and we never should have, and we never will again pursue the corruption of our political system, secretly, legally, but secretly coming into to elect two corporation commissioners. I just think that's so wrong that it's got to be distanced. It's got to be affirmatively stated that this was a mistake. And as was just mentioned, the people involved should not be, and that's not just Don Brandt. That's other folks that were at the company that led this parade, probably strategized it, and I think took a great company into a very wrong direction.
Well, Marcus, given that Brandt is still scheduled to testify in a few weeks at the Corporation Commission, do you think there might be some of that at that time? Like, since he's sort of on his way out, does that seem like a time that maybe he would say, look, I made some bad choices, sorry?
It doesn't make any sense coming from him. I'm expecting him to get sick on the day he's supposed to testify. If it were me and I was retiring, I'd suddenly have the flu.
I have an urgent golf date.
But that being the case, even if he does, if he goes to the hearing and he testify, that's not your maximum effect is to have Don do it. The maximum effect is have to the incoming leader of the company do it. And to that end, I'm not too sure that this platform, this specific hearing where we're talking about, customer safety and political spending and other things is the right place to do that.
Plus with Don Brandt sitting right next to him.
Yeah, it's just I would make that a separate issue. And tackle that issue that you've got to at the CorpCom and then move on from there.
Terry, to close out on this topic then, so obviously 2020 elections are going to be wild and nasty, maybe even the nastiest we've seen, who knows. So how close are you going to watch APS and Pinnacle West? Some of the strategists, at least one who was purportedly involved in some of this, is still with the company at a pretty high level. How close are you going to watch how involved they may be in the Corporation Commission race, what these ads look like and whatnot? Because you're involved with an Outlaw Dirty Money campaign, certainly, but generally, do you think that part of the mea culpa actually we will be able to see in a solid way when election time comes?
Probably not. The nature of the beast is that Arizona is more permissive of dark money, of secret funds going into politics than almost any other state in the country. I think they could put their finger on the scale again in the Corporation Commission. They would not break any laws. Potentially have a big impact on the result. Arizonans are more alert to this kind of a problem, so I think the mere allegation that they're trying to put their finger on the scale for the Corporation Commission is going to have a negative impact on whoever people think. But I'm afraid that in its way becomes a form of dirty campaigning when you can't verify who it is that's supporting various ads. And that's the nature of the beast right now in Arizona, and APS in the past took advantage of it. Now it's become almost a negative, and there are false accusations of dark money being used. So I think it's time we cleared the decks and got a clear disclosure across the board, and that's what I'm fighting to do with our petition.
Marcus, same sort of question, though. Would the mea culpa include sort of concrete examples of saying, yeah, we're going to give money, that's our right to do, but maybe not Corporation Commission?
It very well may. I think if they spend on the Corporation Commission race, we're going to know. The fact is there's no secrets anymore. And even if, let's just say, Terry somehow misses the fact, which would never happen, that APS was spending money on Corporation Commission. There is a racist. There is 100 other people out there in Arizona right now, especially in the journalistic world, that are going to be focused on that exact topic. So they're going to be under a microscope. And I don't think it's worth it for them to spend money on that race and try and funnel it through whatever various entities.
They have a target on their chest. That's absolutely right. And I think many will be watching. But bear in mind, this was not something that fate cast them into. It was a self-imposed liability that they are suffering from. And frankly, the suffering is richly deserved. They never should have done what they did. They've subjected all the ratepayers to a $95 million annual rate increase. Business and customers alike are suffering for that. Never should have happened, and frankly, just a mea culpa probably doesn't do it. I think the company has got to swear off any involvement in the future ever with the regulated board. And if they don't, I think the legislature will force them to it.
Marcus, we heard from two retired Supreme Court justices this week looking into problems in the state corrections department. Of course, Charles Ryan recently announced he is retiring. I'm curious what you made of the report. The recommendation seemed basically, well, we need more funding. You need to check this stuff a little bit better. But they also kind of had some harsh words for the outgoing director, Charles Ryan.
Yeah, here's what the whole thing's interesting for me from this concept is that the legislature has had a line item in their budget for 20 years for door locks. And every single year it doesn't get funded. I shouldn't say every single year. There have been a couple years where door locks have gotten funded. But it's not like the department and the director have not been pointing these factors out of what's going on at DOC. Whether the legislature implemented those is a completely different question. But we've known that these problems exist for a while. This newest example, I think the report says it didn't get all the way up to the director. I find that somewhat interesting in that I think that they did know that there was a door locks issue. We've talked about it for 20 years. I think that there's some people out there celebrating Chuck Ryan's decision to retire. But at the same time, who's getting the better end of this deal? I mean, this job stinks. Let's be clear about that. There's nothing fun. And frankly, finding people to do that job is really hard. It takes a toll on your wife. It takes a toll on your kids. You are committed to this job. And so it's not going to be as easy as everybody thinks to find a replacement.
Terry, I'm curious, as you ran a state agency, I mean, what is the responsibility of the director in this case to really have a good sense of what's going on in the department?
When prisoners are getting out of their cells and assaulting guards, I think the guy in charge that should be the thing that wakes him up at night. So I guess I'm a little surprised at the report's allegations that he didn't know, or that he said that the first he heard about it was when a television crew actually filmed people getting out of a locked cell. That's pretty outrageous. But add to, and I'm not an attacker of Charles Ryan. I think he's done some very good things on education, trying to prevent recidivism, the kind of thing that I think prisons need to do more of. But and not an evil person, but it's a very tough job. It's the kind of job that I think makes people somewhat callous. You know, you're dealing with really awful people, and they still have rights, and they still need to be I shouldn't use the word cared for. They need to be confined in a way that isn't blatantly abusive. And I think that was his goal, but the health care problems in the prisons, which were very serious, led to some court actions that were then not observed. I think we've had a series of problems that are not way beyond the director. I mean, this is a corrections institution that needs a lot of help, but I think the point of 20 years having the locks on the agenda and not being funded makes the point. I mean, it had become a very, very dangerous place unnecessarily.
That's Terry Goddard. Also here with us is Marcus Dell'Artino. With Mark Brody, I'm Steve Goldstein. We're in the midst of the Friday newscap, which continues after this. It's the Friday newscap here on KJZZ. With Mark Brody, I'm Steve Goldstein. Our guest this week, former Arizona Attorney General Terry Goddard and Marcus Dell'Artino of First Strategic. Marcus, we love early polls. They're really fantastic. especially what yes, is this? 15 months out from November of 2020. It appears, based on one poll, that Mark Kelly and Martha McSally, pretty tight. Mark Kelly may be pulling ahead a bit at this point. I don't want to make fun of polls. I'd like to talk about them. But at this point, does it make any sense, frankly, to talk about this?
I'm glad you asked that question. I really am, because I think you're making the exact point. I mean, it's polls are fun for the media to talk about. It gives us a subject matter, and it's fun for the political, you know, jibber-jabbers. But they mean absolutely nothing at this point, because no campaign has actually been conducted. No messaging's been done. Nobody knows anything. Look, here's what we know about Mark Kelly. He's an astronaut, and he's married to Gabby Giffords. Both great things. I love it. But we don't know virtually where he stands on very many issues and what his vision for Arizona is. And Martha is clearly going to run a different campaign. She's shooken up her team. I think that was a wise choice. And so they don't mean a whole lot. But I will tell you this. What we are studying right now at our firm is the growth in voter registration of the different parties. And I will tell you that I'll be candid with you. The Republican Party's got a lot of work to do, especially in Maricopa County and Pima County, to keep that. It's not the straight numbers right now that you're looking at voter registration. It's the growth moving forward that they need to keep an eye on.
Yeah, Terry, what are your thoughts?
I agree with Marcus. This is almost farcical to have a beauty contest poll this early when, as he said very correctly, the campaign hasn't started and people haven't focused on it. I saw two things that I would think would be very hopeful for Mark Kelly. And one was he's still substantially unknown by like 30% of the people responding. And Martha McSally is not. They know her. So I think Kelly is moving ahead, and trending is important. The numbers, hey, you could argue about a few percentage points. There's no way that's accurate, but 15 months from now. But the trending is important, and he's got a solid movement over the last 6 months that, frankly, is in his favor.
But briefly, do we expect this race to be nip and tuck, regardless of whether we're 15 months out, based on whether it's voter registration, based on the fact that the McSally Sinema race was so close? Can we take any of those factors as we look forward?
Oh, absolutely. But let me tell you a little bit more as we dive into this. Look at the amount of money these two have raised already, and it's blistering. And to give you some perspective on that, there's, 20 people running for president of the United States on the Democratic ticket as we speak. If you take all the money raised from those candidates, Mark Kelly and Martha McSally would be fifth and sixth on that list.
So they're in the debate.
So they should be running for president of the United States at this point. I mean, it's fascinating. Now, you combine that with what Senate seats are up in this current cycle and where the Democrats are likely to win, where Republicans are likely to win. Arizona is the number one target, and Mitch McConnell knows that and needs to protect this Republican seat to be able to keep the majority. Folks, you combine that with a presidential election, we are going to have more money spent in Arizona than you have ever seen in your life. Your TV commercials will be I know they were nonstop last cycle. If it can get any worse, it's going to get worse. If you are in the TV business,
this is an awful prospect.
expect Christmas bonuses if you're in the TV business, because they're going to be making more money, and your mailbox is going to be.
I'm not going to check my mail for the next 8 months.
Exactly.
Well, it's interesting you mentioned fundraising, because after that poll came out, our email inboxes have become flooded with fundraising appeals touting some of those numbers. So I wonder, while it doesn't necessarily tell you where the race is, because nobody really knows where the race is at the moment, what kind of effect does it have in terms of fundraising for either candidates or for outside groups who are trying to influence that race?
Oh, yeah, well, and that'll be the other factor. I mean, the outside groups, to Terry's favorite subject, the dark money will be astounding in this campaign. But that's what you do at this point, right? You use that poll, which, by the way, the poll could be completely made up and be the worst science ever, but candidates are going to use it for a fundraising, right? So I'm only 3 points behind, send me $50. I'm only 3 points up, send me $50. Whatever the message is, there's a way to put an email together to get your $20, $50, $250 bucks.
Terry, let's move on to Attorney General Mark Brnovich and his battle against the Board of Regents, which has been going on for quite a while, various lawsuits. Court of Appeals this week made an interesting decision. Part of the decision, Mark Brnovich is going to appeal. And without getting too legalistic, but as a former Attorney General, tell us about the significance of what a couple of the judges said related to the power of the Attorney General and the work he or she must do with the governor.
Well, when I read the first part of the opinion, I was pretty disappointed because it seemed like they were making some very procedural decisions about a legitimately serious constitutional issue and an issue that if the AG doesn't raise it, there's a serious question about who can. So this is the whole issue about whether our Constitution that says university education should be as nearly free as possible is enforceable. And if so, when have the universities crossed the line? And I think to his credit, A.G. Brnovich was trying to get that issue before the courts. And I think he deserves a hearing on that. One way or the other, it needs to be resolved. It should not be sitting out there. What the court did was first affirmed the dismissal by the district court, which I found unfortunate. But they did it in a way that essentially teed up this issue for the Supreme Court, because a court of appeals can't overrule a Supreme Court decision. They're bound by it. And the decision in this case is called McFate, and it's been around since the 50s. And it basically says that an AG in Arizona, McFate was a land commissioner, and he was sued by an attorney general, and the suit was thrown out because saying this guy, the AG doesn't have any authority in Arizona to do that unless the governor gives him permission. Well, that's really bad law. And what the Court of Appeals did was they basically wrote a brief as a concurring opinion, which says McFate is a terrible decision. It's time we got rid of it. Supreme Court, pay attention. And I think that was an actual textbook for the Attorney General to say to the Supreme Court, here it is for you. Your decision has been written. McFate has been screwing up our constitutional system in Arizona for many years. Let's have a clean slate and let the AG be what he should be, the attorney for the people.
Yeah, and Marcus, the Board of Regents, Governor Ducey has not liked the fact that Attorney General Brnovich has gone after the Board of Regents when it comes to tuition on this.
Yeah, there's no doubt there's a little tension on this issue, but certainly if you talk to the people, they fully support General Brnovich. This question, I agree with Terry 200%. The question needs to be answered. What is affordable when it comes to college tuition? What's interesting is, you know, I think, and Terry said it so well, is that when you read the initial part of the decision, you come to one conclusion. Clearly, when you get to the end, and Brnovich planned on it, that we've gotten to a different conclusion. I mean, Brnovich was almost crazy like a fox or smart like a fox. I'm not too sure. But his whole purpose was to finally get to the Supreme Court, and this does that for him.
So do you think that ultimately the court will be weighing in on university tuition once the McFate decision is dealt with?
The procedure will be, assuming that they buy what the three justices on the Court of Appeals say, repeal McFate as bad law and then remand to the district court for a real case, a real lawsuit.
On the issue
that was raised by the Attorney General. And he may win, he may lose. But I think he's entitled to make a hearing before a court of law that here's a constitutional standard. I think that based on certain increases in tuition that's been exceeded, the universities will obviously come in saying there were lots of mitigating factors and we still have very low education costs in Arizona. That's a good point. It needs to be made. And maybe some bumpers will be established.
So, Marcus, when Mark Brnovich is governor then, presumably he'll push the legislature to increase funding to the universities.
I'm not too sure General Brnovich wants to be governor. I mean, he's certainly one of the leading candidates. But
Grateful Dead will be the state band.
He would love that. You know, he's a great candidate. There's no doubt about it. But let's also remember that, you know, he may want to go into private service and, you know, make a decent check and spend more time with his family.
And wear beautiful shirts like you do.
Well,
it has paid off, my friend.
Thank you.
And he deserves that.
And yeah, that's absolutely true. And there'll be plenty of Republicans to run. There's no doubt about that. But, yes, if he were governor, he may get a budget that asks for a little more tuition.
And that is Marcus Dell'Artino of First Strategic, former Attorney General Terry Goddard. Guys, thanks for being here today. We appreciate it.
Great pleasure.
We appreciate
Thank you.
Being here.
Undocumented high school graduates in Arizona will now pay about half as much as they once did to attend the state's public universities. The State Board of Regents voted yesterday to make undocumented students eligible for a tuition rate that is 150% of in-state tuition. That means that where undocumented students once paid the out-of-state rate of about $30,000, they'll now pay about $16,000. Rachel Longang is a reporter for the Arizona Republic, joins us now to tell us more about this decision. Rachel, good morning.
Good morning.
This does sound kind of familiar. This is ground that has been trod upon before by the Board of Regents. Why so significant now? Is it different from what they've done before?
So in the past, people have focused a lot on DACA students, so students who have a permit under the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program. But undocumented students do not have that. And since DACA is now, I guess, like suspended, kind of up in the air with courts, they aren't accepting new applications. There are plenty more undocumented students than there are DACA students who would be going to college. So this is a move to ensure that those students who are in a lot of times the same situation as DACA students will have some sort of path to college that's affordable.
This has been kind of a controversial topic in the past, but it sounds like there wasn't a whole lot of controversy at the meeting when they voted on this yesterday.
No one voted no. There was very little discussion. I do think that, like, the tenor of this debate has changed a lot, and also the regents have been very supportive of anything that will get more people to college. We're not doing super well on college attainment, so they want to have more people going to and graduating from college. I think this is directly in line with that, so it certainly supports their goals. No one on the regents was opposed to it. I think judging from the things I'm getting on Twitter or in my email inbox, there are certainly people opposed. It's just not the people who are on the regents.
Well, was there any discussion? I mean, we had Attorney General Brnovich on the show a couple days ago, and he didn't say quite as much, but he's not a fan of this. He's one of those, and he has shown that he is willing to sue the Board of Regents over other things. Was there any discussion of a possible legal action against this decision?
I haven't heard anything, and this is all, I think the way they crafted this is designed to be within the bounds of what they can legally do. There's a ballot measure from 2006, I believe, that said that in-state tuition specifically is considered a public benefit. Mm-hmm. This is not in-state tuition, and the Regents had done the study that showed the cost to educate someone is about $16,000. So this is the full cost. So they're saying this is not a subsidy. We're not subsidizing them. It should be, I guess, above board legally. Now, whether, like, somebody sues, I don't know. I mean, people sue for all sorts of reasons. I suppose right. It's possible. Certainly the Attorney General and the Regents have not seen eye to eye as of late.
Rachel, from a speculation point of view, I know you don't cover the legislature anymore, but State Senator Heather Carter had brought up some similar notion of this. Does this stop any legislation in its tracks? Does it make it not needed? How could that affect things potentially in the next session?
So her bill and this for the region specifically is almost exactly what she asked for. So there'd be really no reason. She was also trying to direct the community colleges. That's where most students are likely going who are undocumented or who have DACA. They can't offer a lower rate because of that same issue I discussed. Their out-of-state rate is the full cost of educating a student. So they've said they're sort of stuck. It's possible that they could come up with some sort of legislative move for, like, a community college student. But, again, you have this ballot measure. So what are you going to do about that?
You referenced the state's goal of increasing university attainment. Was there any discussion or have you talked to anybody about how much this kind of policy could help toward that goal?
It's unknown how many students this really is because usually people aren't asking, are you undocumented, on forms and stuff like that. So, I mean, there have been reports that say 2,000 undocumented students are graduating each year from Arizona high schools. It's possible that's the full universe. Now, of that, probably, you know, at least half aren't going to be going to universities. It's a relatively small number when you look at the overall enrollment of these really large universities we have here. But, you know, enrollment across the country in colleges has been going down. We haven't seen big decreases in enrollment here because of our growth. So I think people are trying to, like, pay attention to where are our future students coming from.
Rachel Longang, reporter for the Arizona Republic. Thank you, as always.
Thank you.
Fewer Arizona parents are okay with their kids playing football and other contact sports. And many of those kids seem to be okay with that. Those are among the findings of a new survey from Barrow Neurological Institute, which looked at Arizonans' attitudes about concussions. Dr. Javier Cardenas is director of the Barrow Concussion and Brain Injury Center at Barrow Neurological Institute. He joins me. And Dr. Cardenas, first off, what stood out to you about these results?
There's a few things that stand out this year. The first is that we see that parents are still restricting their kids from participation in contact sports. And now it's not just football. It really is many contact sports. In fact, one of the survey questions was, would you allow your child to participate in a contact sport? This year was 65% for yes. 2 years ago was 82%. So we see a decline. And actually what's more significant is this decline has also translated into participation numbers in sports, especially something like football, where we've seen about a 26% decrease between 2015 and 2018.
What do you make of the fact that fewer parents want their kids playing these contact sports? And in fact, fewer kids are saying that they want to play them as well.
Indeed, we see a pretty close match with our youth athletes. In fact, we also surveyed a number of teens. A third of them report that they don't want to participate in sports because of those concussion fears, which is actually an increase from just 2 years ago of a fifth. In terms of the why, you know, we are asking specifically how much concussion plays a role in their decisions to participate in contact sports specifically, and they do have a concern. Historically, the concern was about immediate consequences of concussion, but now we get the sense that they're more concerned about the long-term consequences of single and or repeated concussions over time, and we think that's probably a big reason why parents and teens are straying away from the contact sports.
How much do you think that has to do with conversations on the high school level with your organization and others? And how much do you think it has to do with conversations going on with, for example, professional sports leagues?
I'm sure it's a combination of the two. What we really try to convey with respect to the conversations we have with the athletes, so we do that through our concussion education program called Barrel Brain Book. And we're really trying to deliver a message of identifying concussions and removing from play so that there aren't those longer consequences, but also that a healthy brain is a good brain for athletic activity and participation. And we encourage our athletic activity. We encourage physical activity because the 50,000-foot view is of a state and of a country of childhood obesity. And we know that that in and of itself has significant consequences on heart health and brain health.
Well, have you seen any indication that if parents and teens are less interested in contact sports, which you're identifying as football, basketball, and soccer, is there any indication that there's an increase in interest or participation in other sports that maybe are safer for brain health?
We are actually seeing overall increases in athletic activity across the country, and that actually has to do more with girls' participation in athletic sports across the board. And I think part of the other message that this conveys is really that a lot of people feel that this is more of an issue in boys' sports or boys' predominant sports such as football, when in fact it can be an issue in a lot of girls' sports, especially in soccer.
Have you seen any indications that for teens who do participate in contact sports, if they think they got a concussion or actually did get a concussion, that they are treating it differently, maybe taking more time before coming back to the field or maybe not coming back to the field because of concerns over some of those long-term impacts that you mentioned earlier?
Indeed, one of the positive things that we've seen looking at some of the research is, in fact, more athletes identifying that they've had a concussion and then not going back too soon. And so, yes, we are seeing that athletes are removing themselves. We are seeing that they are allowing time for their brain to heal. They are being supervised more appropriately by healthcare providers so that we don't run into this problem of repeat concussions like we used to.
All right. That's Dr. Javier Cardenas, director of the Barrow Concussion and Brain Injury Center at Barrow Neurological Institute. Thanks a lot for your time. I appreciate it.
Thank you. Have a wonderful day.
This week, we told you about the lack of monsoon. While that might set off alarm bells in some people's minds, the situation may not be quite so dire, not right now anyway. That is, the powers that be are not implementing residential water use limits or requiring specific conservation measures in your homes, And our next guest says that's because water conservation is just a part of life in the desert. Warren Tenney is executive director of the Arizona Municipal Water Users Association, and he joins us now. Warren, it's almost certain Arizona will have to face Colorado River-related cutbacks beginning next year. Does that sound more alarming than it actually is? I mean, how prepared is Arizona?
Well, we have been preparing for this day. We know that the Colorado River is a very important resource for our economy, and we've also known that a shortage would eventually come to the Colorado River. What is important to remember is that this valley is the valley cities have a diverse water portfolio. So they have allocations of Colorado River water that is delivered to us by the Central Arizona Project, or CAP, but we also receive water from the Salt River Project, as well as we put to beneficial use our reclaimed water and still have access to groundwater. So that puts us in a good position here in the valley. As far as for 2020 and the Colorado River, Arizona also was very smart in leaving water in Lake Mead for the last 2 to 3 years. So now in 2020, when we are required to leave water, we're leaving basically the same amount of water as we had before that. Thank heavens Mother Nature really helped out and gave us a very wet winter for the Colorado Rockies, which then has helped to increase also the levels in Lake Mead, which means that we're not going to be at the shortage level that we thought we would be at when this year started.
Where does conservation fit in on this? Are there things that incrementally individuals need to be doing, businesses need to be doing, that would really help the cause?
Well, we live in the desert, and so we know that we need to use water wisely. And the cities have worked very hard here in this valley to establish a conservation ethic. For example, we have seen the city of Phoenix increase its population by 250,000 people since the year 2000, and yet during that time has actually had a reduction in residential water use by 12.5%. We are grateful that the residents here understand that water is precious and therefore it needs to be used wisely. When it comes to things that homeowners can do, we always encourage people to look at how they are using their water. It's kind of like when you're wanting to really take care of your health and you decide to start keeping track of what you're eating. It's the same thing. We just ask folks maybe become a little more conscientious of how you're using water around the home. Also, take advantage of opportunities to reduce the amount of water that you're using outdoors, which is predominantly where you're using more than 60, sometimes up to 70% of your water can be outdoors. And we just really encourage people to take advantage of all the resources that the cities provide. Mm-hmm.
There are many who are concerned about climate change and the effects on the Southwest. Is it going to get hotter and drier? And how could that affect things? Is Arizona going to have to do more innovative things, let's say, even going forward, even more than the state and the valley has already done, to make sure that over the next decade, couple of decades, if there is another extended dry patch, that we are somewhat ready for it, as ready as one can be?
The cities never rest when it comes to water. We're always looking forward. And we know that this was a fortunate year as far as what Mother Nature provided. We have been in a drought for a long time, and we know that that may be the new normal. And so we are looking at the future being drier than what we know. And so we are taking steps to factor that in as we are planning and investing in our water resources and our infrastructure. As far as for residents, I think it's important that they understand that their water providers here in the valley are working all the time on these issues. There's a lot of effort going forward. And because we have a conservation ethic, we've not had to impose water reductions. And I don't see us having to do that anytime in the near future because we all are working together to try to use water as efficiently as we can.
Warren Tenney is Executive Director of the Arizona Municipal Water Users Association.
Tens of thousands of migrant families have passed through Phoenix this year on their way to destinations in other parts of the country. Area churches and nonprofits have offered these people aid, and just last month, aid groups opened a 24/7 shelter. It's one stop on the migrant journey we've been covering over the past 2 weeks. And here to tell us about it is KJZZ's Brett Jaspers. Hey, Brett.
Hey.
So you're out in front of the shelter now. I've been doing some reporting there. How do people get there?
Well, the Department of Homeland Security, the federal government, calls the shelter, you know, the night before or early that morning to say, hey, we have some people for you. And then DHS pulls up mid-morning in a big white bus and lets people off. The shelter itself is an old school, and the first room people enter is a former cafeteria with a large stage area. There's coffee, juice, and things to eat there, and a play area for kids, you know, who waste no time in diving right into the toys.
Not surprising there. I imagine the adults, though, who've arrived are wondering what happens next.
Yeah, so the staff, you know, pretty quickly hold intake sessions with each family to answer questions they have and give them some initial information about finding legal help in the places that they're headed. The staff then will call the families that live in the U.S. to have them buy bus or plane tickets as soon as possible. You know, most people are here really just a short time and somewhere on the way to the Greyhound station within a couple of hours of being dropped off.
So, Brett, who did you have a chance to talk to there?
Well, the group I talked to was mostly from Mexico, 24 people in all. These were parents with their children. And here's a Mexican man I spoke to. I'm not using his name out of security concerns. He and his family were headed to South Carolina.
La verdad, pues, para México hay mucha violencia. Hay mucha violencia. Ya ha matado.
The truth is, there is a lot of violence in Mexico. There's a lot of violence, and that's how a family member of ours was killed. I don't want to be there because of the violence, so I decided to look for help through asylum. But thank God we made it here, and here we are. And during the entire trip, everyone treated us well. And thank God we arrived here.
You know, people were generally in immigration custody for a really brief time, one or two nights, but these are parents with children, like I said, not solo adults and not solo children. Both of those groups typically remain in government custody. Another person I talked to was a woman headed to Tennessee with her two daughters. She told me she waited a month and 20 days on the border before crossing.
We were three families that rented a room. We didn't have much, but between us three, we divided the costs. One family is here, another is, well, we don't know anything. We haven't heard anything since the officials brought us here. They separated us from them. So they haven't arrived here or at the detention center.
The detention center meaning, you know, the Phoenix ICE facility where people spent the night before getting dropped off at the shelter. And just to make clear, these were not family members she was separated from. It was a different family she had met along the way.
Well, have numbers been lower than expected?
According to ICE numbers that I've seen, family releases have definitely slowed in late June and July in the Phoenix area. The IRC says they expected lower numbers because it's the summer, you know, it's obviously really hot, but their spokesman, Stanford Prescott, said they expect numbers to go up in the fall and called it a long-term investment.
This is an evolving situation. The numbers that arrive change month to month. Immigration policies change. And so we'll continue to evaluate the decisions here based on the need. But as long as there's a need here, we're committed to serving it.
So, Brett, what else do they have there?
Well, there's a room for medical checkups if people want them. There's a side room called the Ropa Room where people can get new hygiene products and choose among donated clothes. Nico Vlakovic is a staffer for the IRC. And when I asked her, you know, which item tends to run low, she said pants.
Pants we tend to wear until they're out, like until they're like not wearable anymore. Also, American sizes are way bigger. So it's hard to find pants that are the right size and the right length.
So, you know, they don't have a lot of pants for people, but they do have a lot of new donated stuffed animals, and those were pretty popular with the kids.
All right, that is KJZZ's Brett Jaspers in South Phoenix. Brett, thank you.
You're welcome.
Mark, it's been a pretty uneventful monsoon so far this year, but there's still a chance for this non-soon to turn around.
Did you come up with that phrase?
No, I did not.
Okay.
I wish I could take credit for it.
Yeah, it would be a good one for you. While we could agree we'd like a respite from the scorching temperatures, the wetter weather does bring its own discomforts. Think humidity, bugs, and even storm damage.
Now, most of us are able to weather these conditions in relative comfort, but that's not the experience for some of our communities most vulnerable.
For this week's monsoon story, our co-host Lauren Gilger talked with someone who experiences all the effects of the monsoon.
For many of us, monsoon season is a time of anticipation and relief. We wait for the storms to come and soak up the rains when they do. But today, we want to bring you a different perspective on the season. Imagine being outside during the storm. You don't have a house to retreat to, and you're lucky if you can find some shelter that will keep you at least a little dry and hopefully safe.
Well, you definitely want something to keep you dry.
That's the reality many people experiencing homelessness face every time the monsoon storms roll around.
When it does rain during monsoon season, and a lot of people don't have anything but a wool blanket or something like that to cover up with.
That's Rusty Williams. Originally from Alabama, he's been living out on the streets in Phoenix for several years. And he's one of the lucky ones. He has a tent.
That tent makes all the difference in the world. If you don't have something to put over your head to keep you dry, if you don't have some kind of shade to get into, you're miserable. You're going to be miserable.
We met Williams at the community garden at St. Vincent de Paul's shelter in Phoenix, where he volunteers. We sat in the shade there with the sounds of the heat and planes flying overhead. And he told us about the challenges he and others face during the monsoons. From the rain...
You definitely got to figure out where to go. Or if you don't know, ask somebody. Because the people that's been out here a while, they've got every place that you can go to get in, get out of the rain, they've got it figured out. And if they don't have it figured out, well, you're just going to get wet.
To the humidity that comes with the rain.
That could kill you. You've got to be able to get in, like the shade here, inside where there's air conditioning. We've got little portable fans, battery-powered fans. That helps. But even that don't help all that much.
That tent was his lifeline through the last 3 or 4 monsoon floods, he told us.
And all I had to do was, when I got able to go back in it, was dry the floor up and throw the bed mattress I had in there out. Go find me another one that's being thrown away and right back in there.
But things took a turn for the worse when it was stolen.
I had it set up for, like I said, 10 months before somebody decided they liked it better than I did. I was livid.
Since St. Vincent de Paul got him a new tent, but for everybody else on the streets, well, he says they figure it out.
They don't have a tarp. They don't have a tent. So they just, hey, pass the soap.
So what would help the most during the monsoon season? Williams tells us just being kind goes a long way.
People that goes by, sees individuals out and about. Not everybody out here is drug addicts. There are people out here that's out here due to circumstances that actually wants to get stuff taken care of and get off the street. But due to circumstances, they're having problems. If you go and buy somebody, and if they're strung out, if you can tell they're strung out, give them a bottle of water or something. But if they're not, stop, talk to them. Find out what's going on. Find out what society could do to help them.
Or, if you can, offer them a tent.
And we do hope the Rusty and everyone else can stay cool out there. And the forecast for this weekend is mostly sun. But, Mark, you know the thing about weather forecasting.
What's that?
Well, it can change overnight, especially during monsoon season right here.
That is indeed true. So here's hoping for some rain. Remember, we want to hear your monsoon stories. There's only a couple of more weeks. Hopefully we'll get some rain in that time. Call us at 480-774-8299. Leave us a voicemail with your story. That's 480-774-8299. Or go to monsoon.kjzz.org to submit your best monsoon photo.
That's the show for today. This has been a KJZZ original production from Phoenix. You can find photos, audio segments, and more information about the program at theshow.kjzz.org. I'm Steve Goldstein. Thanks for listening to the show podcast.